This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run, 9:37 right now. I'm Melissa Idris with Kusu Chuang. That was Joe Hasham earlier with my most favorite acronym on BFM, Be Faithful. Love that one. You're listening to Pressing Matters now. It's the show that takes you behind the headlines of the day as we get insights from members of the press corps. Now, dominating headlines this past week has been the situation in Guamusang, Kelantan. If you went back to August 4th, where tensions were high after a blockade that was set up by the Tamiya tribe from the Orang Asli community in Kelantan, that was destroyed by a group of chainsaw-wielding men believed to be ad hoc workers for a plantation. Now, the conflict between the Orang Asli and the planters gained attention of the Prime Minister, Tun Dr. Mahathir, and he had vowed to resolve the issue. So we wanted to get, again, beyond the headlines, just the headlines, and we have on the show today Sheridan Mahavira, a journalist with the Malaysian Insight, and he's been following the developments of this story closely. He joins us today. Good morning, Sheridan. Welcome to the Pressing Matters show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
All right. So you have an article that you've written for the Malaysian Insight, Unseen Hands Behind Orang Asli versus Planters Conflict. Now, we'll tweet out that article so you can click on that and subscribe to the Malaysian Insight if you're not already a subscriber. But for those who haven't been following this story closely, Sheridan, how would you, if you could provide us, say, a historical context to how this conflict began?
The conflict with the Guamusang Tamiya tribe, according to them, started ever since 2012. It goes back that far. When they started up blockades against loggers who they claim had encroached into their tribal lands or what is called the customary lands, Tanah Adat.
Mm-hmm.
The 2012 blockade was subsequently destroyed. That was against loggers. And then in 2016, the community around there, that's there, there's about 18 villages, had started, I think, two blockades, if I'm not mistaken, also against loggers, but this time against plantation companies as well. Because what has happened is that the plantation companies get licenses, get approval to go and build plantations on land that was previously logged. And, of course, you know that now there are suspicions as to whether or not both the loggers and the planters were working together. So the press, I think the press has covered the blockades since 2012. In 2016, I didn't cover it in 2016, but the press that did cover in 2016, there were, I think, two members of an agency that had tried to go in and cover it, and they were blocked and I think subsequently also detained by the forestry department, right, and the police department. And NGOs that had that are trying to help the Orang Asli were also prevented from going into the or visiting the 2016 blockade lah.
So I guess the question for me, since it's Pressing Matters, is really from an editorial perspective. The coverage hasn't really been lacking because I think most of the mainstream media, as well as online media like yourselves, have covered it. I think it's the extent of intellectual honesty in terms of covering this kind of story which is most germane at this point in time, Sheridan. Because I think, okay, I want to cite Sarawak Report. And in the way they cover the story, there seems to be additional layers behind the onion as to what motivates the state governments and the people that might have an interest in developing that land versus the other side, which is the Orang Asli and the NGOs that might be helping to underwrite their efforts. Now, in terms of how this story is covered, how honest can you be in this new era of Malaysia Baru in terms of talking about the vested interest, in terms of talking about the sections that might be compromised, right, in terms of why these things are happening?
So going beyond the
correct
surface, right?
Correct.
Yeah. I think it's not just in Malaysia Baru lah. I think even in the old Malaysia, the same type of standards and limits apply, in the sense that we want to go beyond we want to go beyond the story, like you said, beyond the spectacle of the blockage itself to look at the underlying factors. But then we are also constrained by, you know, we don't want to get sued, for
sure.
instance,
Correct.
By the Kelantan government or right. by you know, or by the businesses involved.
Okay, can I just clarify that the stakeholders involved are the multifaceted, right? So you've got not just the Orang Asli Temiah tribe, then you've got the planters and the loggers, then the Kelantan state government,
Correct.
Then
and the federal government,
and
as
the
well.
Federal the prime yeah. minister is now involved, yeah. and you've also got NGOs and right. activists involved yeah. in this. So very.
So if you can just put two sides, right? There's always side A and side B. Side A might be the Kelantan state government and the corporate interests that have probably avowed licenses and certifications that have enabled them to develop this land. So on one side, the Kelantan state government and the corporate interests, whether they're loggers or growers of durian, Musang King, for example. And then on the other side, you've got the Orang Asli,
the community.
And the NGOs, right? The,
right?
That might be wanting to defend their land rights. Mm. And then I think in between all this is the federal government.
Trying to play referee.
Trying to play mm-hmm. referee and trying to be neutral in this whole equation. So
yeah.
I just want to ask you, in the way you cover the story, who has been the most accessible? Because sometimes the extent of accessibility always, well, sometimes goes to prove a point as well.
Yeah. So in terms of accessibility, I think, you know, if you look at it, if you can find an analogy, a more Klang Valley analogy, lah. You know, it's like you have all the residents of TTDI who are trying to protest against the, you know, the
Bukit
destruction
Kiara,
of Bukit Kiara. Yeah. So if you look at the TTDI residents as being the Orang Asli,
yeah.
and then the Bukit Kiara as being their communal lands, and the Yayasan Wilayah Persekutuan that is trying to develop the land,
mm-hmm.
then you can get an idea of what the conflict entails. So, of course, you know, in such stories, the most accessible will be the community.
The defenders of that.
Correct. Because
property.
Because
yeah?
they feel, because the thing is, they feel that their interests, that their views were not taken into consideration by the developer. You know, and by the state government. Because, you know, just like Bukit Kiara was supposed to be reserved, if I'm not mistaken.
Right, yeah,
it was supposed to be reserved land. So why are you now starting to go and build in there?
So this forest in yeah. Ulu Kelantan, just how valuable is it? Is it really just about the
I think plantations? I think the thing is, it's the forest in Ulu Kelantan is more valuable, to the rest of Kelantan than it is to just the Orang Asli. I spoke to a NGO called Kuasa, that is based in Perak, but they themselves have gone and studied the destruction of the forest. It's called the Ulu Kelantan Forest. The Ulu Kelantan is called the Bala Forest Reserve. And it says that, you know, it provides, it's a big water catchment area that provides clean water, raw water to almost half of Kelantan. And when it was destroyed by logging, when it was environmental degradation, the rivers would all silt up and it just made the 2014, it was a contributing factor to the devastation of the 2014 floods lah.
Yeah, so the easy analogy here would be Sabah, Sarawak, right? And the degradation of the forest there.
Yeah.
And for example, being too late to the game and being too little too late in terms of saving Borneo's rainforests. In this case, it's Kelantan, and Kelantan's kind of like a new area
yeah.
for the corporate interest to be pulling.
Well, I think
right?
that's a valid point because, you know, this is, I guess, like a barometer or like a litmus test as to what's happening around the country, right? Conflicts between businesses with indigenous communities, especially agribusiness when it comes to indigenous
yeah.
communities,
yeah.
for sure. All right, we're going to come back with Sheridan Mahavira from the Malaysian Insight, who's been following closely the situation in Guamusang, Kelantan. More on pressing matters in just a couple of minutes. Stay with us right here on The Morning Run, BFM 89.9. Good morning. This is Pressing Matters on The Morning Run. Pressing Matters is the show that takes you behind the headlines of the day. We speak to the people who bring you those headlines and get behind the story. Today, we have Sheridan Mahavira, a journalist with the Malaysian Insight, who has been following the developments in Guamusang, Kelantan with the Temiah tribe of the Orang Asli community. So, Sheridan, and now coming back to a little bit about your coverage of this story, How do you filter through the noise? Because, you know, at some point, it's just become a he said, she said. We've got the M7 company that's involved in this this conflict. They've come out to say, well, actually, they are the victims from you know, being manhandled by the Orang Asli community, if I could paraphrase their statement.
I think they didn't really say that they were manhandled.
They said they are the victims
because the Orang Asli had put up blockades in front of a access road, so they haven't been able to, you know, conduct their business and grow their Musang Kings. I think you know, in terms of like, say, press coverage, and yes, that you're right, there is a lot of noise, and I think. But because I have been covering this issue, I've been covering the whole Orang Asli issue since my days in the Malaysian Insider. If you still remember that website, in 2009, if I'm not mistaken, 2009 or 2011, and it was then that, you know, I got like, say, a kind of a big picture view of essentially what fuels the conflicts, yeah, between the community and business interests, between the community and state government interests, and that's why I came up with the analogy of TTDI and Bukit Kiara. So the thing is,
what is the big picture here?
So the big picture here is that you see, the thing is, it's like they are fighting for it not just their way of life, but the way in which they can get clean water, food.
Is this an accurate depiction? You've been there? You've seen it?
This is what,
in full glorious Technicolor?
I've not just been here. I've also covered the Temuan,
okay,
who were relocated from what is now Daman Sara Perdana, right? There's this village called Desa Temuan, which they live, and you'll be surprised to know that I was surprised that after I think about 8 years in which they were relocated there, they were given skills, in fact, of how to manage in the new industrial economy.
Uh-huh.
Almost when I visited, almost 60% of them went back to live near the forest.
So they don't want to be integrated. They don't want to be in the new
That's the thing. When you say that they do not want to be integrated, it's kind of pejorative, because you see, the industrial economy foisted something on them. If you leave them alone in their forest, which is about, like, you know, they're claiming
it's only not
maybe,
large, yeah?
Yeah, it's not large. They can get food, water, shelter, building materials. It's also their mosque, their temple. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a very integral part of their identity. It's right. Not very different. It's not very different than maybe, like, say, us, who live in our houses, but we need the clinic, the mama shop, the bank, the roads.
It's,
you know,
it's just what yeah, is for you, it, right?
It's, yeah. It's, yeah, it's essentially so, you know, they need this ecosystem just like we need ecosystems. You know, we who live in the industrial economy need these little ecosystems that are in our townships.
I think that matters so, become complicates matters when we've got the issue of native customary land rights, right? So with the Guo Musang case, the issue of land rights comes into play right now, you know, because you're saying, well, this is my piece of land, and, you know, you've got planters, and the state government's not recognizing that. I'm just wondering, Sheridan, your thoughts on now that you've got the Prime Minister involved, which was a first, right? The Prime Minister
correct.
Coming to the ground to see what's happening was a first for realized.
I mean, we have to kind of qualify that. I mean, it's the first time a Prime Minister actually came down to see protesters that showed up at their door, at his doorstep, because
okay.
they essentially are protesters. You know, when you hand over a memorandum, there are protests. I mean, it's not a formal engagement. It's not a formal setting whereby you decide, okay, today is Orang Asli Day.
Yeah,
and then,
it's not a meeting
then,
room.
Yeah,
right?
And then we have this big celebration in Stadium Deka, and the Prime Minister goes there. that probably has happened before, but yeah, this is the first time a sitting Prime Minister goes down to meet protesters and says, okay, you know, can I, you know, I am prepared to listen to your demands.
So what is the significance of that? What do you think, what do you think that brings to the table now?
I think in that sense, what this new government has done, and I think this is an achievement that this government, that we can pin on this government, in the sense that they are prepared, not just from the Prime Minister, but from Siva Rasa, the first, you know, who is a deputy minister for rural and regional development, who went down to meet the orang asli at their blockades, you know, to get a true picture, an accurate picture of what is going on, and who actually told them, yes, the federal government is going to step in and negotiate, you know, help you negotiate with the state government. Right. This has never been done before, because the previous a cabinet minister from the previous administration had gone to see the orang asli when they had, because the blockade had started since February. And the cabinet minister had just said that, oh, you know, this is all because the land is under the state, so this is just a state matter. We cannot do anything.
Do you think that the role of the media has become even more pronounced post May 9th in terms of really highlighting these issues, putting pressure on the politicians?
I think
stories like yourself as well.
Yeah, yeah. I think so. I think it's not just the orang or the orang asal, orang asli. Yeah. I think you guys had, you know, this great discussion on LGBTQ rights,
the other day.
So it's still ongoing.
It is still
going
ongoing.
Away.
No. And I don't think Panama issues about the orang asli rights are going away either. But at least, you know, groups that were vulnerable. And I think you also had, like, say, a discussion about Muslim minorities, right? Shi'as and Ahmadis.
Mm-hmm.
Groups that were vulnerable, that felt that they were marginalized, that did not have their voices heard in the previous, in the old Malaysia, you know, are now coming forward and trying to see whether or not, you know, the new Malaysia can give them a better deal.
Well, I love speaking to members of the press like yourself, Sheridan, who have been on the ground, who are looking at it from a multiple perspectives. Tell us, what are we missing from this story? What perspective have we not been looking at, you know, not been talking about? Often we get trapped in our Damansara Heights bubble. You know, so Han calls it the Bangsa bubble, Damansara Dome, Subang something.
Shell.
Subang Shell. That's right.
I remember that.
That was
Subang Shell.
He was
Petaling Jaya.
Petaling Pit. Yeah. So we were trying to coin that phrase. Anyway, but we often get caught in this bubble. What's missing from this story that we... What have we missed?
I think we could... to go back to what you were saying just now, we can still... drill down into, you know, the corporate interests and the links that they have to the state government. Because I think one aspect that has not become, or it's been mentioned before, that you know, the state, that Kelantan relies on its forests because it has very few resources in order to earn an income. But, you know, the thing is, it's always, you see, a question that not just Kelantan faces, you know, I think Kedah also faces the same thing, right? And they have this vast tract of forest called Ulu Muda that supplies water not just to Kedah, but Kedah and Penang as well. So, you know, they have had to grapple with that as well. But then, you know, they are going a different direction, right? They're meeting stakeholders, meeting the Penang government, they're trying to hold discussions into saying how, you know, we can preserve this, whatever we have in Ulu Muda, and so that it can continue to bring value and continue to serve.
So to truly give the story a voice and to take it as far as it can go, it's all about resources. And the Malaysian it doesn't have unlimited resources. So is there a commercial element? I mean, outside of the New York Times or the Financial Times, who do have the financial wherewithal to pay for these resources, is there a commercial element to how these stories are covered in future, in time to come, do you think?
Commercial in terms of, we can't go to Gomusang every weekend.
Correct. I mean, but will advertisers support this initiative going forward, you know, whether by foundations or via, you know, maybe wealthy individuals that might want to see a better Malaysia? Or even a paywall, for example, which I think you're trying to introduce.
I think that's a whole philosophy behind the paywall. If you like our journalism, then pay for it. You know what I'm saying? I mean, that's what.
But that's a tough ask, isn't it?
Well, it is. But then it's not really a tough ask, because, again, if you look at the people who read us, right? There, I know they are willing to pay $12 to have coffee at Starbucks or, you know,
which
all
is
these
insane,
other.
Yeah.
It's not insane, because it's their choice, correct? But, you know, if you can spend 14 hours on a product that probably gives you satisfaction for maybe only an hour or maybe 3 hours, you can, you know, take some of that money and pay for a product that probably can give you satisfaction or teach you enlightenment or you know, give you something that you can use, you know, to better understand your world for maybe 1 month.
Yeah, I completely agree, because, you know, it's beyond headlines, right? It's not just the first paragraph that you're reading. Yeah. Often stories as complex as what's happening in Guamusang need more unpacking, need the journalism, the boots on the
continued
ground.
Continued coverage.
Correct.
Continued coverage, because it doesn't, because you only mentioned, like, say, one story, but then we've been covering the Guamusang blockades since February, when they first started.
And kudos to the Malaysian Insight for that.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Sheridan, for joining us on the show. We've been speaking to Sheridan Mahavira, journalist with the Malaysian Insight. Keep up the good work that you're doing there.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your support.
I'm Melissa Idris with Kusu Chuang for Pressing Matters right here on The Morning Run. We've got the 10 o'clock news bulletin coming up next with Lynn Mark. So stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.